You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, tax cuts and clean water are just two of the issues state lawmakers may tackle in the weeks ahead. We'll talk with Democratic and Republican legislators on their top priorities for the year. Now, President Trump is offering more explanations about what led the U.S. to kill Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani last week. At an unrelated event at the White House today, Trump was asked about the strike and the members of Congress who were upset with him for not disclosing more of the details leading up to it.
We caught a total monster, and we took him out, and that should have happened a long time ago. We did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy. We also did it for other reasons that were very obvious. Somebody died. One of our military people died. People were badly wounded just a week before. And we did it. And we had a shot at him, and I took it, and that shot was pinpoint accurate, and that was the end of a monster.
Up until today, the administration had said Soleimani was planning imminent attacks on U.S. personnel, but didn't elaborate. In the meantime, Iran's U.N. ambassador said that the missiles that were fired at U.S. military bases in Iraq were payback for Soleimani's killing, and that there were no plans for additional attacks unless the U.S. hits Iran again. Carl Kaltenthaler is a professor of political science and director of security studies at the University of Akron. He's also an adjunct professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. He's an expert in counterterrorism in the Middle East, as well as a consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, this mention kind of off the cuff, it seems like, the president saying we did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy. What do you make of that statement from the president today?
It's possible that the intelligence said that. It's hard to tell. Obviously, this is stuff that's kept under wraps because it is intelligence. You don't want to reveal sources and methods or what we specifically find out. So that could be what they saw, or it could potentially be an exaggeration. I don't know.
Right, because this had been after Iranian-backed groups in Iraq had been protesting by the U.S. embassy, attacking it in some ways. So it may have just been a statement about what was happening there. Is that one way to read that potentially?
It is possible. And another thing that's been going on is there have been mortar attacks and even rocket attacks into what's called the Green Zone. So the Green Zone is part of Baghdad that is walled off from the rest of the city where the embassies are. And our embassy is within the Green Zone. So that area gets attacked every once in a while. In fact, it just got attacked within the last 24 hours. We're not sure if it was aimed exactly at the embassy, but it fell fairly close, the fire. And so, you know, that could be what he's referring to.
Well, let's step back from the president's statement there and look at the lead up to this attack. Have we seen an escalation from Iranian-affiliated groups in Iraq when it comes to attacks on U.S. personnel or bases?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been a lot of rocket attacks against U.S. bases in Iraq. Part of that is to pressure the United States to leave the country, and I believe part of it is also to provoke an American response. So the idea is that you don't want to provoke an overwhelming military response from the United States, but you want to provoke a response that's going to make American forces in Iraq even more unpopular than they are. And we saw that as a response to the Soleimani attack, that there was a lot of anti-American sentiment generated within Iraq, and there was a lot of pressure put on politicians to make the United States withdraw. So these rocket attacks, they did provoke the United States. I'm sure the Iranians never thought that it was going to go as far as it did with an attack on Soleimani. But to a degree, the Iranians, while they lost a very, very influential and powerful figure within their political sphere, they have got the wind at their backs now in Iraq to get U.S. forces to withdraw. And that is definitely a goal for Iran.
When people were talking about U.S. Strategy and policy in Iraq when it comes to Iran, go back even a week in time. Was anybody talking about a targeted strike against Qasem Soleimani?
I never heard it in the circles that I speak to. That was something that I had never heard of except in the media and in the recesses of the media that had been discussed in the past. in terms of Obama and Bush looking at policy options to deal with Soleimani, because he was such a powerful adversary to the United States and our allies in the region. But it was always looked at as a very remote policy option because it was considered too potentially dangerous. The consequences were too difficult to foresee in terms of what it would bring about if we were to kill Soleimani. And so I was fairly shocked, I have to say, when I saw the news report saying that Soleimani had been taken out, and in the way that it had been done, too. That also, to me, was fairly shocking. Right outside of Baghdad airport, that was not what I was expecting.
Carl Kaltenthaler is with us from the University of Akron, looking at ongoing tensions between the United States and Iran. Carl, looking at what both countries are saying now, it seems like things are not spiraling in a more destructive direction right now. It seems like both countries stepped back a little bit. Is that a fair way to look at what's happened over the last, 24 hours?
Absolutely. I don't know if I'd even say a little bit. I think I'd say a lot. Both countries, I think, are sending very clear signals, pretty unambiguous signals, that they want to de-escalate this situation. And to me, that's a very positive thing, because that means that we reduce the likelihood of having cross signals where people may get into a conflict that they didn't really want to get into. Both sides are making it pretty clear that they want to de-escalate and they want to work this out peacefully. As I've said many times to many different audiences, neither of these governments want war. But at the same time, they both have interests that they're trying to achieve. And this is the core problem, is that the American interests and the Iranian interests in the Middle East are on a collision course. They have been for years. It's very difficult to come to a negotiated settlement that makes both sides feel like they're safe, that their interests are protected.
President Trump, in his speech about the Iranian missile attack, laid out kind of a timeline. President Obama reaches this nuclear deal, returns money to the Iranian regime, tries to engage with it. And that, President Trump said, in effect, led Iran to do worse things, to be more aggressive in its actions in the Middle East. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know if I would agree with that assessment. I think that a lot of people, myself included, were relieved to see a deal reached with Iran where Iran was clearly and openly not moving towards nuclear weapons. And so what I mean by clearly is that they had inspections. And so those inspections showed that Iran was not moving towards a nuclear weapon. Did Iran do other things in the Middle East that we didn't particularly like? Yes. Some of those things include developing ballistic missiles and helping develop and arm and fund proxies that were looked at as dangerous to America's allies and potentially to America's own security interests. And so what the Trump administration is trying to do is essentially get a much bigger deal than simply getting the Iranians to not develop nuclear weapons. They want a deal where the Iranians no longer fund, support, arm these various proxy groups, and they stop developing ballistic missiles. That's a very tall order, because to do that, you have to essentially get the Iranians to say that they're giving up on some of the central tenets of their security policy. They look at these proxies, these allies of theirs in the Middle East, as essential to their security. Because Iran does not have the conventional capability to defend itself against America or its allies. They have a pretty weak navy. They have a pretty weak army, pretty weak air force. What they depend on are these proxy groups, for example, Hezbollah, these militias in Iraq, to keep what they view as keep them safe. And so if a U.S. demand is that Iran has to stop supporting these groups, it's difficult to see the Iranians do that.
We're talking about ongoing tensions between the U.S. and Iran with Carl Kaltenthaler. He's a political science professor and director of security studies at the University of Akron. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? What do you think about where things stand as of this moment with Iran? Do you think that the administration made the right call in this targeted killing of Qasem Soleimani? Or are you worried about that leading maybe to war? Should President Trump have gotten congressional approval or at least consulted with Congress about that strike? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're talking about the ongoing tensions with Iran. Carl Kaltenthaler is our guest, professor of political science and director of security studies at the University of Akron. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about things stand with Iran right now? What do you think of the way the president is handling the situation? Was this targeted killing of Iran's military commander, Qasem Soleimani, the right move, or do you worry that it brings us closer to war? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. And then, Carl, we have this tragedy in the midst of this, this Ukrainian airplane taking off from Tehran. A lot of conspiracies will go around about this, but we're hearing reports from American and Canadian intelligence sources that it looks like some kind of Iranian missile launch, possibly by accident. How does this factor into all of this?
Well, I think it's very embarrassing for the Iranians because I think it's most likely that after they launched the missiles, they were expecting potentially an American response. They very likely could have thought that this was an American airplane that had come into their airspace, and they launched countermeasures against this plane, and it turned out to be a tragedy. This is one of the things that you see when you have countries on very high alert. There's a lot of tension. Unfortunately, these kinds of unintended losses of life happen. So this is why it's good to ratchet things down, to not have everybody thinking that an attack is imminent, and we'll have less of these kind of tragedies happen.
I want to get your thoughts on Iraq and its government now and the concept of Iraqi sovereignty. We've got Iran's now deceased military commander doing a lot of operations within Iraqi borders. This American strike without apparently consultation with the Iraqi government targeting that Iranian leader just outside of Baghdad. What are the Iraqis looking at as they're caught between Iran and the United States?
Iraq right now is in a very, very precarious place. Iraq is reeling from domestic political unrest with demonstrations against the government. There's a huge amount of unrest in the country, dissatisfaction with the political status quo. And so that is enough for the Iraqi government to try to handle. And the response in Iraq to these protests has been brutal. And part of that brutal response has come from militias that are aided and directed by Iranian security officials. So there's also a lot of resentment in Iraq. I would go so far as to say real anger towards Iran for supporting this government and supporting these militias that have really not done anything to help Iraq in terms of bringing good governance, clean governance, that kind of thing. At the same time, Iraqis are increasingly frustrated with the United States because they believe that the United States is to a degree fighting a proxy war against Iran in Iraq. So Iraqis are being put in the middle. They're being punished for something that they didn't start. So this has the potential, this tension, this tug of war between Iran and the United States, to destabilize Iraq further than it already is. And that could be very detrimental to the Iranians, the Iraqis, and the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. There's so many reasons this is wrong. I could go on forever, but the main comment I had was that Trump said he was going to go after 52 sites, including cultural sites, and this is an international war crime. And his ignorance is astonishing, and his amoral attitude, I know he took it back, but the genie is out of the bottle. And I just wondered how this rhetoric is so inflammatory and dangerous in the world.
Jordis, thanks for the call. Carl, that comment from the president targeting multiple sites, including cultural sites in Iran.
Yeah, well, I've talked about this with people both in the United States and in Iran. Just today, I had an interview with Iranian media. And, you know, both sides are engaging in heated rhetoric. And a lot of this has to do with trying to placate their domestic bases. And, you know, you've got to wonder how much of this is actually directed at the other side to try to deter them from doing something, or if this is just meant to, you know, make their domestic political supporters think that they're being tough. They're not showing weakness in the face of the other side. I think both sides would do well to ratchet down the inflammatory statements. They don't help anything. And hopefully we'll see that into the future, that both sides will kind of, you know, think twice before they say some of these things, which just don't help the situation.
Jordis, thanks for the call. Jack joins us now in Caledonia. Jack, hello.
Hi, how you guys doing? Yeah, my comment is about the different fashions in the Middle East with the different countries, leaders with the different sects, the different warlords, the different clans. Somebody should make a chess game board, you know, with different pieces and that, you know, so people can understand who's on whose side at what given opportunity.
Jack, thanks for the call. Carl, it's a complicated political landscape, but not an understatement at all.
No, absolutely not. The caller is very accurate in describing it as a complex place. And, you know, the more you get into this area, the more complex you realize it is, because, you know, it's not just sects of Islam or regional differences, ethnic differences. There's also tribal differences that play a very large role in many of these countries. And the sects themselves are fragmented. Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to what goes on in Iraq and Syria because of the security implications of those situations. And it is tremendously complex. Just following, for example, what's going on in Iraq right now, in the face of the Soleimani killing and then the Iranian response, to track all the different factions of Iraqi politics that are at play right now, vying for influence with each other. It's tough. And so, you know, one of the things the United States needs is people who know these things, because you can make the wrong decisions if you don't understand who the various actors are, what their interests are, what capabilities they have. So, you know, this is why our intelligence community, for example, really wants area experts, people who know this area of the world, so that they can give good clarifications of what's going on and what potential policies could mean.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Carl Carlton Thaler is with us from the University of Akron, looking at the latest with the U.S., Iran, and the region. Back to your calls now. Bradley is with us in Tupelo, Mississippi. Bradley, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Bradley?
Okay, really quickly, where does Israel fit into all of this? I haven't heard a thing, and I would like to get your guest's opinion on that.
Bradley, thanks for the call. All I've heard, Carl, is it sounds like Israel is trying to stay at arm's length from this dispute, at least in public statements.
You're absolutely right. Israel is trying to stay out of this. They do not want to get brought into this for several reasons. One, Israel does not want to get into a conflict it doesn't need to be involved in. The other thing is that when Israel gets involved, it creates a whole new dimension to the conflict because of how radioactive Israel is in the Arab world. So to keep Israel out is good for Israel, and I don't think the United States necessarily wants to get Israel involved in this either. And I don't even think the Iranians do. As much as they talk about death to Israel and they want to destroy the Jewish state and all that, they are very wary of Israel. They know Israel's capabilities. They know Israel does not hold back from retaliating against attacks. So Israel is staying out of this, and I don't think anybody else really wants to drag Israel into it.
Another country that doesn't seem to want to be dragged in is Saudi Arabia. What do you make of their response to all of this?
Yeah, this is interesting. I've talked to some Saudi officials recently about this. They were very concerned after the Soleimani attack that potentially they would get targeted. Saudi Arabia's defensive capabilities or ability to take on Iran are not as strong as Israel's. They do have a lot of backing from the United States, but Iran has shown a capability of hurting Saudi Arabia with the attack that happened, for example, on the Aramco facilities there. And those were carried out by proxies of Iran. So Saudi Arabia, they also don't want to get involved in a conflict. There's nothing to be gained from them in getting involved in a conflict, particularly in a conflict in Iraq. Most players in the region want this to die down. They want this to be a chapter that they would like to move from and then hopefully get a more stable Middle East.
You said most. Is there someone you see potentially benefiting from an escalation of conflict there?
Yeah, some group that we haven't discussed at all so far, and that's ISIS. ISIS benefits from this, and so does Al-Qaeda. And the reason for that is that ISIS benefits particularly, even more than Al-Qaeda, from Sunni-Shia conflict. So anything that looks like Shias are gaining power or that there's a Sunni-Shia conflict in the region, that helps ISIS. Another thing that helps ISIS is when the U.S. government is distracted from its fight against ISIS. And we saw that happen this week where U.S. forces stood down in their anti-ISIS operations because they were expecting an attack from the Iranians. But the other thing is that the Iraqi government, because it's so preoccupied with the protests and now with this political turmoil caused by the Soleimani strike, their eyes kind of off the ball when it comes to fighting ISIS. And a lot of people incorrectly think that ISIS is down for the count. ISIS is weakened, certainly, but ISIS is still engaging in an insurgency in Iraq and in Syria.
Lots to keep our eye on, Carl. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Carl Kaltenthaler, professor of political science at the University of Akron. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. After a tumultuous year in state politics, lawmakers are getting ready to get back at it in 2020. But it's not looking like they're going to be in session for very long, as only a handful of days are scheduled. There's no budget to pass. Republicans and Democrats disagree on a bunch of the major issues. Plus, it's an election year. So what can we expect to happen this year? We'll get two takes on that this half hour. Coming up, we'll talk with the Republican Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke. First, Jennifer Schilling is a Democratic state senator from La Crosse and the Senate Minority Leader. Senator Schilling, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's look back before we look at this next year. 1 year into Governor Evers' first term with a Republican-controlled legislature, how do you feel generally about where things sit today compared to a year ago?
Well, certainly one of the highs was a new era with new leadership under Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call and Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. It's been great having the ability to work with a Democratic administration. It's something that we as Democrats in the legislature haven't had that in the last 8 years. And the past made it clear that there is overwhelming public support on issues like Medicaid expansion, medical cannabis, gun safety, and investing in our local schools. And I think we worked closely with our Assembly Democrats, holding simultaneous press conferences across the state to unveil our Forward Together priorities. And within the Senate, we welcome Senator Schachner and Senator Smith to our caucus, and they've been great additions representing Northwestern Wisconsin. So there are certainly some high points in 2019.
The big picture, though, is a Republican-controlled legislature, Democratic governor. Do you feel like there were opportunities for bipartisan cooperation that might have gotten lost in the shuffle?
I do, and I think one of the lows certainly was the pettiness that we saw occur in between the Republican legislature and the governor's administration. It's the session had been frustratingly slow with important issues that still need to be resolved, and Republican leaders want to be in as little as possible. I think in the Senate we met maybe 9 times in 2019. So it's clear that the majority party wants to slow play Governor Evers and kind of run out the clock on his agenda, ignoring really the interest of voters to address these issues that there is a lot of bipartisan and common ground on.
Well, let's talk about some of those issues where maybe there could be some common ground. I've heard people from both parties talking about why did it work on water issues, clean water issues here in the state. Is that part of your agenda for 2020?
Well, and this week we saw a bipartisan package on water quality bills unveiled. Certainly 2019, Governor Evers declared it's the year of clean drinking water, and both the governor and the legislature had task forces to address water quality issues and come up and develop a plan. Certainly the governor is looking at ways that we can focus on nitrates in our groundwater, non-point pollution, PFAS, lead in our drinking waters, and decreasing pathogens in our groundwater. And the package of bills, 13 bills that were unveiled earlier this week, about $10 million package. I hope we do have support in a really short window of January and February. We're expected to be in until April, according to the calendar, but legislative leaders have indicated that we may adjourn as early as February or early March. So there certainly is a lot of issues that we need to roll up our sleeves, get to work on in western Wisconsin. Flood recovery is certainly one of my priorities as we look at mitigation of water and looking at well safety. And I'm pleased that one of the bills that my colleague and I in the La Crosse area introduced about notification to well owners about contaminated wells is included in that package.
One of the issues you mentioned that we may not see a lot of cooperation on, the brief special session on gun purchases, taking up a red flag law, expanding background checks. Do you see any room for progress on gun-related legislation in this short session?
Unfortunately, I don't see that. I think that is a great missed opportunity. I think it is a public health concern. It is a public safety concern. The governor called for a special session to address, I think, really thoughtful and reasonable efforts on closing the gun store loophole, looking at being able to extreme risk protection orders. And the Republican legislature gaveled in and gaveled in out within a matter of minutes. And so I hope that we can address one aspect, which is increased mental health services. I think that's one solution. It's one that I think we've seen some common ground on. It's not the only one, but if we try to forge some bipartisan solutions, it seems that mental health services is one area that we have done that in the past. And I hope after some situations in high schools in Wisconsin in December that we can prick the consciousness of the legislature to address some of these issues about access to services and medical help.
Talking to State Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling, Democrat from La Crosse, looking at her party's priorities for 2020. State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says Republicans are going to work on a property tax cut this session. What are you looking for in that package?
Well, I think as Democrats, we've consistently pushed for tax fairness. It starts with closing the dark store loophole. That loophole allows corporations to shift their tax burden on homeowners and small businesses. It's the reason why we've seen a hike in property taxes. I know our local units of government, our partners in county and city government would like us to address it, as many communities, unlike, you know, La Crosse is similar to many communities that have seen closing of big box retail stores and even some that remain open. That are challenging their property tax assessment, and that shifts that tax assessment and tax burden onto homeowners. So I think we would certainly like to see closing of that corporation, that dark store loophole to reduce a hike in property taxes. I think it also goes back to restoring tax fairness when it comes to funding our schools And another place to look at lowering taxes is by funding our schools. And it's simple math that when previous legislatures have slashed school funding for corporate tax breaks, local homeowners are forced to pick up that cost to keep school doors open. So I hope that we can have a good conversation. The governor last year had put forward a plan for an income tax cut that was sustainable and reasonable. That was met with opposition from the majority party, Republicans. And as we go into a conversation of tax fairness, I hope we can look at a comprehensive look when we're looking at assessments in our community and supporting our schools for property taxes.
Another issue that's been contentious, a couple of Republican lawmakers have now recently introduced a bill that would allow for medical marijuana in the state. Party leadership, Republican Party leadership, not necessarily on board with that, though. Does that give you hope that Republicans are starting to turn toward your point of view anyway when it comes to medical marijuana?
I think positions are evolving. I think legislators' viewpoints and education are evolving and kind of moving the needle on that. A proposal that Senator John Erpenbach and Chris Taylor, who have been advocates on this issue for years, would allow patients to access medical marijuana if authorized by their doctors or if they have a valid registry card from DHS. And I do think that most people view medical marijuana as an issue of providing comprehensive health care with dignity to those with serious illnesses, and it's medical research, scientific studies, personal experiences are clearly supporting the use of medicinal marijuana. So a recent Marquette Law poll found that 83% of Wisconsin residents support cannabis for medical purposes with a doctor's prescription, and it's currently legal in 33 states, including border states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois. So I hope that we can follow the success of medical cannabis of all three of those states that have legalized it.
In our last minute or so, any other priorities that we haven't talked about yet you want to see come up early in 2020?
Well, in 2020, we're talking about elections, and I think redistricting needs to be on people's mind. It's certainly one that we're not going to solve and address in the next 8 weeks that we meet, but I think moving past 2020, looking at the census and looking at our next legislative session, fair maps and redistricting certainly is something that we need to address. We have seen really the gerrymandering of our state, and many county boards have put together proposals and referendums on fair maps, and it certainly is something as we look at the future of our democracy here in the state and being fairly represented and making sure that the public and voters can select and elect their lawmakers rather than lawmakers drawing the map to select their voters. I think is redistricting is something as we look ahead that we need to make sure is a priority, and we hold elected officials accountable as they're out on the campaign trail over the next summer and fall talking about it, but it will be something that we'll have to do, and certainly including the governor as a backstop and having a seat at the table that a Democratic governor can weigh in as well with this Republican legislature on what the maps look like for the next decade.
Senator Schilling, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jennifer Schilling is a Democratic state senator from La Crosse and the Senate Minority Leader. We talked to her about the Democrats' legislative priorities for the new year. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're getting a preview of the upcoming state legislative session and looking at issues lawmakers may take up in the weeks ahead. We just heard from Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling, a Democrat. Now we get a Republican take from State Representative Jim Steinecke, the Assembly Majority Leader. Representative Steinecke, good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, looking back to start things off, as we did with Senator Schilling, how do you feel about where Wisconsin is 1 year into the Evers administration?
Fairly good. I mean, I think we did our best to find areas of agreement over the course of last year with the new governor. I think that showed in getting the budget done on time without, dramatically raising taxes. So I think that was overall a pretty good success. Nobody got everything that they wanted. Some, each side had to give and take a little bit, but we got it signed on time. Unfortunately, the only Democrat that supported that was Governor Evers. So we'll have to look to do better next time, and hopefully we'll get more Democrats to jump on board like Governor Evers did on the budget. But That was probably the biggest thing. And another thing that we're proud of is the fact that we did work in that bipartisan manner. Almost everything that got passed through the state legislature was had some form of bipartisan support. So I think the first year, you know, it was difficult. We're all trying to find our legs underneath us in the new relationship, but I think it's going okay.
Well, one priority I know for you is the issue of homelessness in the state. What can we expect to see over the next couple of months on that issue?
Well, we're going to continue to make the push for the funding to be released. Everybody in the state budget supported the level of funding for homelessness. We passed the policy after the state budget was passed. Now all that's left to get the money out the door is for the Senate to put the policy on the floor and get that passed so it can get on to the governor for his signature. So we're going to continue to make that push, and hopefully we can get that done in the next couple of months.
Now, there's been some finger pointing both ways on the fact that we're well into a Wisconsin winter without getting those I's dotted and T's crossed to get that homelessness money out there. Are you frustrated by the holdup?
Yeah, I'm always frustrated by the legislative process. It's slow, and a lot of times it's on purpose, you know, to make sure that we have a deliberate process. Sometimes it's more deliberate than we'd like, and that's the case here. This is a conservative approach led by Rebecca Clayfish, our former lieutenant governor, to make targeted investments where we can make a difference in people's lives and either keep them from becoming homeless or, once they do, get them back on their feet quickly. So I'm hoping the few senators that are still holdouts on this will come around and see it that way.
This is a non-budget writing year. So budget aside, what is your top legislative priority for this session over the next couple of months?
Well, personally, for me, it's going to be passing a pilot program to deliver mental health access directly into the schools to help teachers and administrators better recognize the signs of mental illness in their children, and also to help them deal with those mental illnesses as they present in the classroom. So that's my number one priority beyond the homelessness stuff. But as a group, I think the legislature, we're looking at passing a package of clean water bills that we just put out this week, dealing with the issue of criminal justice. John Nygren has HOPE agenda bills that are going to be coming up this year that continue to deal with the opioid crisis. And we're going to continue to make pushes on things like that.
Let's key in on one of those, the clean water issue. That was a issue for Governor Evers. He highlighted it in 2019. I've heard Republicans and Democrats saying this should be a priority. What kind of things are on the table in the package you just mentioned?
Well, I mean, there's quite a few, so I'm not going to get into all the details of all of them, but because some of them are pretty complicated. But the main thing that we want to focus on is, like, up in northeastern Wisconsin, Kewaunee County, we have a pretty big issue with nitrates. Up in Marinette, there's the issue with PFAS. So we're looking at everything that we can do to make sure that we can, make a marked improvement in the groundwater for the people of the state.
Talking to Jim Steinke, Republican State Representative from Kaukauna and Assembly Majority Leader, looking at some Republican priorities for the legislative session, the new session. Earlier we heard from Democrat Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling. Senator Schilling, who we talked to just a few moments ago, said she hopes there's bipartisan support for closing the dark store loophole. People talk about that a lot, where stores, large buildings are assessed for property taxes. Is that an issue you're interested in dealing with?
Well, it's, you know, everybody calls it, people tend to call it a loophole, but it's not really a loophole. I mean, it's the way the state law was written. Municipalities were not assessing properties according to the law. That's why when these retailers and big box stores and others are taking the state to court over their assessments, that's why they're winning in court. So we have to figure out if there's a compromise there, because dramatically increasing taxes on retailers, especially at a time when retailers are struggling to get by, I'm not sure that's exactly the route to go. So hopefully there's a compromise to be had, but it's been a difficult road to get there.
Staying with taxes, Senator Fitzgerald in the other chamber talking about property tax changes in Wisconsin, trying to cut property taxes. Is that a priority for you?
It's always been a priority for me ever since we got in the legislature. And I think if we're able to continue to make investments in clean water and homelessness legislation and other things like that. And we have taxpayer money out there after those efforts are complete, then I think it's entirely responsible to send that back to the citizens that paid them in, because we don't want to just take that money and continue to grow state government. We want to take it and give it back to the people who sent it to us.
We've seen a couple of Republican lawmakers introduce a bill to legalize medical marijuana in Wisconsin. This has been a long-running contentious issue. A lot of our neighboring states have made a move in that direction. Is that something you think should or could happen this year in Wisconsin?
I think it should. I don't think it will. I think there's at this point there's probably too much opposition in the state Senate to get that done. So we're going to have to focus on making the case for that going forward. And I am hoping over the course of the next 2 months we can continue to work on the issues where there is broad bipartisan support instead of focusing on issues that where we know that there isn't.
Are there other issues that you see room, maybe even on the small stuff, where Democrats and Republicans can build some trust and work to get things done together?
Sure, there's always that. I mean, I think the thing that the general public doesn't understand or isn't reported well enough for them to understand is that a vast majority of the bills that get passed do have bipartisan support. So most of the stuff that we do does have that cooperation between both sides. It's just some of the higher line issues where we can't find areas of agreement, that's what tends to be reported on. So I think the people need to know that pretty much most, 90% of the stuff that we do does have that level of bipartisan support.
Does the fact that it's an election year get in the way sometimes of being able to work together?
Election years always get in the way of being able to work together. Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate because I've always, in my campaigns, I always talk about issues. I never get personal. I very rarely even talk about my opponent because I think that's my opponent's responsibility to get their message out there, and it's not mine to define what that message is. I feel comfortable running on my record, and that's kind of where I leave it. So hopefully more candidates across the state will do that.
We heard from Senator Schilling about a call for redistricting reform, accusations that Wisconsin is gerrymandered. We've got another map drawing session coming up pretty soon. Do you have thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I just have to, this is the one issue where I just don't understand where the Democrats are coming from, because before the maps were redrawn in 2011, in the state assembly, the GOP had 60 seats. Now we have 63. There hasn't been a massive shift. It's all about demographics. More liberal-leaning voters are moving into the urban areas. More conservatives are moving out into the rural areas. It's just that's the way it's going to look. And if you really wanted to get to 50-50 seats, you'd really have to gerrymander the seats in a very strange way. So I think they're focusing on the wrong things. We have representatives in majority Democrat seats, I think three or four of them right now. So we win in seats where Barack Obama won and Hillary Clinton won. And Tammy Baldwin won 18 of the, I think it was 18 of the seats where Republicans won. So I think it's less about the district lines and more about the quality of candidate.
Representative Steinicke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Steinicke is a Republican state representative from Kaukauna and the Assembly Majority Leader. Earlier, we talked to the Democratic Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse. We talked to both of them about the upcoming legislative session and their priorities for 2020. That session is scheduled to begin on Tuesday. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the United Methodist Church has agreed to disagree and split into two separate institutions over differences of opinion on same-sex marriage. They're not the first denomination to face this issue. We'll find out how LGBT issues are shaking up churches. We'll look at the impact of farm subsidies and tariff relief payments on farmers in Wisconsin and around the country. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some secrets to making great New Orleans-style food in our home kitchen. That and more on Central Time.